If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
You fellas want to read me my rights?
You have the right to have your face kicked in by me. You have the right to have your balls stomped by him.
I'll waive my rights.
They're pretty simple. The forms are all standard, boilerplate.
Okay, well, we're all hungry. We're going to get to our hot plate soon enough, all right? But let's talk about the contract here.
Sorry.
You'd be surprised how many doors a letter from a lawyer can open or close.
It seems like you're talking slower since you started charging by the hour.
What's the meaning of this? This is my quiet time.
We're gonna have to take you into custody.
That's outrageous. What am I charged with?
Don't have to tell you anymore. Clearly haven't been reading your Scalia.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 183. And how are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic. I feel like my audio is rich and vibrant. I'm super happy.
We'll see. We haven't got... I hope it is. I'm glad you can hear yourself. And I also am... I'm wearing my white shoes and my... I got the whole getup. Oh. We are a white shoe legal podcast here. We are fancy as F. All right. today we are going to be talking about dissents in 8-1 cases. What an awesome theme. I love that.
Yeah, there are two recent cases that have just both come out at the Supreme Court level. Both are 8-1. Both surprised me. And so I want to see if we can learn some lessons, if we can, if you can guess who the dissent is and on what grounds. I mean, we're going to have a lot of fun with this.
Well, I was going to make a guess that by, not quite by definition, but it would seem as though a dissent in an 8-1 case is going to be like a pretty cranky dissent. Like you're not going to have like a, you know what I mean? I just feel like if you're the only justice dissenting, you're going to be like, guys, what? What are you doing? You know, I feel like it's going to be, but we'll see. I don't know if that assumption is correct.
Yeah, we're gonna challenge it. I will tell you, 8-1 is the least common alignment of any Supreme Court decision. It is actually, it's a U-shaped distribution, right? The most decisions are either 5-4 or 9-0. And 8-1 and 7-2 are the least likely. Yeah, and I'm going to link an article in the show notes. It's that goes through some of the statistical analysis because, right, as when I was in law school, I was asked that question. And, you know, you would sort of think like, oh, okay, well, the Supreme Court takes a lot of tough questions, right? So most cases should be 5-4,
right.
And then some will be 6-3, some will be, right? And it should be, you know, in relationship to the difficulty of the question. Turns out not remotely the case. And maybe we'll get to figure out why.
It makes sense to me, actually, because it's like either it's a partisan issue, you know, where we're at 5-4 because there's, you know, the partisanship of the Supreme Court, or it's an issue that doesn't, it's so obvious that everyone's like, all right, fine. I know. I don't know. Kind of makes sense to me, but I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, but part of it is you learn as a lawyer that only hard cases get to the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. right? So you would think there shouldn't be that many 9-0, but it turns out there are a lot. So
interesting.
We'll see.
All right. Well, let's get to it. Down the law, down the law, down the law, down the law.
Our first case is Collins versus Virginia. Again, these are both very, very recent cases. This is an 8-1 decision. And let's start off with the fact. The facts are fun, right? So it begins with a police officer in Albemarle County, Virginia, right? Matthew McCall. And he observed the driver of an orange and black motorcycle with what is called an extended frame. I don't know what that means. I don't know if you do. I don't know if you're a motorcycle guy.
I don't know what a motorcycle's extended frame would look like, I guess.
Yeah. I don't either. But anyway, orange and black motorcycle. What the majority describes as committing a traffic infraction, and what the dissent points out is traveling in excess of 140 miles an hour. So guy zooms past a cop on this orange and black motorcycle, 140 miles an hour. The driver, the majority notes, eluded Officer McCall's attempt to stop the motorcycle. Yeah, I bet, right? Like, I don't think you can crank one of those Ford Tauruses up to 140. A few weeks later, Officer David Rhodes of the same department saw an orange and black motorcycle traveling well over the speed limit, but the driver got away from him, too. So the officers compared notes. They decided that the two incidents involved the same motorcyclist. Okay. Upon further investigation, the officers learned that the motorcycle likely was stolen and in the possession of petitioner Ryan Collins. After discovering photographs on Collins' Facebook profile that featured an orange and black motorcycle parked at the top of a driveway of a house, Officer Rhodes tracked down the address of the house, drove there, and parked on the street. It was later established that Collins' girlfriend lived in the house, and she was renting the house. That may influence your decision. Ooh. So I will add that it parenthetically.
Oh, so you're not going to tell me which way it went, and I have to guess. Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Oh, okay. Right.
And Collins stayed there a few nights per week. From his parked position on the street, Officer Rhodes saw what appeared to be a motorcycle with an extended frame covered up with a white tarp, parked at the same angle and in the same location on the driveway as in the Facebook photograph. And remember, on Facebook, he's showing off. He's like, you know,
yeah.
I get on Facebook.
Check out my speedy motorcycle thing, right, that we that Andrew and Thomas don't quite understand.
Right. So Officer Rhodes, who did not have a warrant, exited his car and walked towards the house. He stopped to take a photograph of the covered motorcycle from the sidewalk and then walked onto the residential property and up to the top of the driveway where the motorcycle was parked. In order to investigate further, Officer Rhodes pulled off the tarp, revealing the motorcycle that looked like the one from the speeding incident. He then ran a search of the license plate and vehicle identification numbers, which confirmed that the motorcycle was stolen. He gathered the information, took a photograph of the uncovered motorcycle, put the tarp back on, left the property, went back to his car, waited for Collins to get home, asked him a couple of questions. Hey, is that your motorcycle? Oh, yeah, it is. Did you buy it? Yes, I did. Okay, well, you're under arrest. And so Collins was then arrested.
Wait, yes, he bought it? I thought they thought it was stolen.
No, that's what Collins said.
Oh, I see. He was
lying, right? Like, he's got the evidence that, you know.
What you're saying is criminals are sometimes not trustworthy.
This is the Eli Bosnick cops theory of the law. So he's interrogated by the police officer. The police officer says, really, you bought this? Yeah, okay, you're under arrest. And so Collins is arrested and charged with receiving stolen property. And here we have two different kinds of exceptions to the Fourth Amendment that are at odds with each other, right? And so, as you know, the Fourth Amendment provides that persons will be secure in their persons, places, homes, and effects from unreasonable searches and seizures, and that no such searches will issue except upon a search warrant issued with probable cause, right? There's no probable cause here. We all agree with that. So the first question is, are you secure in your home when it's not your home, right? It's your girlfriend's home. Uh-huh. And you're not talking about inside the house, right? You're talking about in the driveway, right? Do you have a right to an expectation of
to
privacy?
A covered
for,
motorcycle. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
For a motorcycle you've covered up on your driveway. And the answer is, right, if this were a stack of gold bricks in the driveway, right, the answer would be, absolutely, yes. There would be no argument about it whatsoever. You have an expectation of privacy for something you stick a tarp on in your driveway. And this provision is called the curtilage exception. So as you might imagine from that word that, you know, just rolls right off the tip of the tongue, curtilage, this is left over from 13th century Saxony law. It's this longstanding principle that says When it comes to the Fourth Amendment, the home is first among equals. At the amendment's very core stands for the right of a man to retreat into his own home and therefore be free from unreasonable governmental intrusion. And to give full practical effect to that right, this court considers curtilage, the area, quote, immediately surrounding and associated with the home, to be part of the home itself for Fourth Amendment purposes. Right. So the protection afforded the curtilage is essentially the protection of families and personal privacy in an area intimately linked to the home, both physically and psychologically, where privacy expectations are the most heightened. Okay, so that's principle number one. In your driveway, there's this curtilage, and that's, we think, key to understanding the Fourth Amendment's guarantee to you being secure in your home against unreasonable searches.
Seems straightforward then.
The other side of the coin is what's known as the automobile exception, and it's pretty straightforward. It says there are two things that we think about when it comes to motor vehicles, right? That there's a big difference between searching someone's house and searching their car because, number one, a vehicle can be quickly moved out of the locality or jurisdiction in which a search warrant must otherwise be sought. And so the ready mobility of a vehicle provides an exception to the otherwise legal requirement that you have to get a search warrant. Right. And then there's a second provision which suggests that people have a lessened expectation of privacy in their cars because of, quote, the pervasive regulation of vehicles capable of traveling on the public highways. And the court goes on to note, automobiles, unlike homes, are subjected to pervasive and continuing governmental regulations and controls, including periodic inspection and licensing requirements. As an everyday occurrence, police stop and examine vehicles when license plates or inspection stickers have expired, or if other violations such as exhaust fumes or excessive noise are noted, or if headlights or other safety equipment are not in proper working order.
Right, but they don't do that in your house.
True, right? Those are the two principles that are coming up against each other. The curtilage exception, which says you have an expectation of privacy for a vehicle parked in your driveway, and the vehicle exception, which says, if we're talking about searching a vehicle, you have a lessened expectation of privacy when it comes to your vehicle. We don't want to have a strict requirement that requires officers to go out and get a search warrant because you could drive that vehicle away, right? And then the evidence would be gone. So if I told you the case is 8-1, how do you think the court came out?
And this is the current court we're talking about?
The current court. This is 2 weeks ago. Actually, a week and a half.
I mean, this just feels obvious to me. You don't have a warrant. Yeah, okay, you have a little bit less expectation of privacy in your car, but I don't see why that would translate into, okay, so you can just get searched on your own property. I really don't think this should be particularly close. And I guess it was 8-1, but I can't wait to find out it went the other way. Because I know you've talked about the Fourth Amendment being kind of eroded and stuff like that. So if Justice Smith were answering, I would say the cartilage exception, still holds or whatever, or not exception, the curtilage rule or whatever. I think that should still hold. That's my opinion. Now, in terms of predicting where this went, I really don't know. If I have to guess who the one dissent was, maybe it went the other way, but one person actually cares about Fourth Amendment rights or something. Who would that be? I'll pick, who are the extremes? It's usually like Gorsuch or Alito or maybe it's like Ginsburg. How about Ginsburg just for fun?
All right. Now I'm gonna do the Monty Hall. Problem here.
Every word of what you just said was wrong.
No. The Monty Hall problem is, I'm gonna tell you, it was not Chief Justice Roberts, right? So I'm gonna open the door, one of the remaining doors, and I'm gonna give you a piece of information. I'm going to read my favorite line.
Why did you just
line.
Tell me it was not Roberts? What did that have to do with
it? You know, because that's the way to make it the Monty Hall problem.
Oh,
right?
Just like eliminating one so that my odds are better on.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to give you the option to switch, right?
Yeah.
So it's not Roberts. I'm going to give you the option to switch. And slightly distinguishing from the Monty Hall problem, I'm going to read my favorite line from the dissent, which is.
Yeah, this is really not going to end up being a Monty Hall problem, but okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I know. But I wanted to reference it.
That's
anyway,
fine.
Because I missed
it. It's an interesting mathematical thing. But anyway, go.
So the dissent says in its best line, the Fourth Amendment is neither an ass nor an idiot. The court's strikingly unreasonable decision is based on a misunderstanding of Fourth Amendment basics. So with that in mind, do you want to stick with your original choice of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, or do you want to go for what's in the box and pick somebody else?
What was the first quote? I can't, it was a little muddled.
The Fourth Amendment is neither an ass nor an idiot.
Okay, well, that's, I would be very shocked if that's Ginsburg. So I will not stick with that, but it has nothing to do with the odds change. Like, John Roberts was not anywhere in my guess of who dissented anyway. So I think odds-wise, it's not like the typical Monty Hall problem. But, so it does seem to be somebody who cares about the Fourth Amendment then. So it seems like it went the way Justice Smith would want it to go. But who cares about the Fourth Amendment? Who would write that? I'll just switch to Alito. How about that?
I love that because you have switched to, in fact, Justice Samuel Alito, who wrote the dissent, but it came out the other way. So
it came out the other way. Oh, wow.
But you picked Alito. You got it right.
So okay.
This was 8-1 in favor of applying the curtilage rule.
No, that's how I said, right? Applying the curtilage rule.
Okay. Yes. This is the moment on Let's Make a Deal where everybody dressed as a sheep in the audience is going crazy and like throwing nickels at Monty Hall. You have switched your answer to the exact correct answer. This was an 8-1 opinion. It came out in favor of the applying the curtilage rule here. And the lone dissent was Samuel Alito.
Why we had a mix up though, because it does sound like, so if I thought the dissent cared about the Fourth Amendment, I had that part of it wrong. So what? Right. So I'm curious about the quote then.
Me too. So let's get there. Me too. I think, and I'm going to read a little bit from the dissent, because to me, I want to illustrate that this is precisely what Alito says in his dissent here is precisely the kind of legal realism that if a justice on the left had done this, would be pilloried as judicial activism. I think. You tell me what you think. Here's what Alito says. If the motorcycle had been parked at the curb instead of in the driveway, it is undisputed that the officer could have searched it without obtaining a warrant. The principal rationale for the so-called automobile or motor vehicle exception to the warrant requirement is the risk that the vehicle will be moved during the time that it takes to obtain a warrant, and that the owner of an automobile has a diminished expectation of privacy in its contents. We went through that. That's a correct statement of law. So why does the court come to the conclusion that Officer Rhodes needed a warrant in this case? Because in order to reach the motorcycle, he had to walk 30 feet or so up the driveway of the house rented by petitioner's girlfriend, and that by doing that, Rhodes invaded the home's, quote, curtilage, which, you know, you can sort of see Alito's disdain for the word equivalent to yours here. This court does not dispute that the motorcycle, when parked in the driveway, was just as mobile as it would have been had it been parked at the curb. Mm. Nor does the court claim that Officer Rhodes' short walk up the driveway did petitioner or his girlfriend any harm. Rhodes did not damage any property or observe anything along the way that he could not have seen from the street. But, the court insists, Rhodes could not enter the driveway without a warrant, and therefore his search of the motorcycle was unreasonable, and the evidence obtained in that search must be suppressed. An ordinary person of common sense would react to the court's decision in the way that Mr. Bumble famously responded when told about a legal rule that did not comport with the reality of everyday life. If that is the law, Mr. Bumble exclaimed, the law is a ass, a idiot. The Fourth Amendment is neither an ass nor an idiot. Its hallmark is reasonableness, and this court's strikingly dissenting unreasonable decision is based on a misunderstanding of Fourth Amendment.
So Thomas's assumption at the top of the show that this is going to be a really, what did I say? This is going to be really kooky whenever there's an 8-1 dissent so far holds up, because this is a load of crap. I don't know what in the world he's talking about, but okay.
Well, so let's drill down on that a little bit. I mean,
if your possessions were 30 feet to the right, then they could search him. Well, yeah, I mean, there's a meaningful difference between being in the place where you have a right to privacy and not. Like, I don't find that to be that compelling of a difference.
Well, so I don't know what the way your house is laid up, but I have I have a driveway, you know, just a slab driveway. It's not covered or anything. And then I've got a spot on a public street, and my wife and I each have a car. And so sometimes we park, usually she parks her car in the driveway and I park my car on the street. But I'm really, other than the fact that my driveway has a tree that overhangs it. And so, you know, like birds will crap on the car if I park in the driveway or whatever. Like from an expectation standpoint, I'm really indifferent as to whether I put my car on the street or in my driveway. And so Alito's question is, from an expectation standpoint, right, from the history and intent and purpose of the Fourth Amendment, why should we treat the driveway differently than the street simply based on, you know, this arcane rule? What do you say to that?
I don't know. I think that it we have to draw these lines somewhere. And I think it's reasonable to draw the line at, is this on the part of my, you know, property that is traditionally treated as part of the house? This, you know, cartilage rule says that this is considered that, and therefore that's fine. It doesn't, I don't think whether or not you or I or non-lawyers know the cartilage, except I'm just saying that it's curtilage, right? I know the curtilage rule. I don't think our expectation and how familiar we are with that arcane thing should be the determining factor. I think the law has been interpreted to be that, and so therefore that's what it is. I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think it should matter that a bunch of people might be wrong if they don't expect privacy in their driveway, you know, but they would in their garage or something. You know, I don't think that should be what determines it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I was trying to make the best case argument that I would. I think the very easy response to Alito's dissent here is the response that you gave, right? Which is, any principle of law is going to require some arbitrary line drawing, right? So, you know, suppose we were to extend it, right? We were to say, yeah, you're right. It is weird that we would treat the driveway different than the street. Certainly a valid response to that, if you are a believer in an expansive Fourth Amendment, would be like, and so let's extend that protection to the street, right? Like, even though it's not technically your property, let's extend it to the street. And then you would have the same 30-foot rule, right? If I get home late at night and somebody's parked in my spot on the street, right? My wife's parked in the driveway. Someone's parked in my, so I got to park around the corner up the hill.
Right. Well, but what I would point out, and sorry, I don't know if this is exactly where you're going, but if someone's parked in your spot on the street, your answer wouldn't be, oh, I'm going to call the cops, they're in my spot. But if someone's parked in your driveway, you'd be like, what the hell is someone doing in my, like some stranger? You know, I think there is a very meaningful difference between driveway
that's,
and the street.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. I was just thinking, regardless of where you draw the line on the curtilage, you'll always be able to make the 30-foot argument, right? If I'm parked around the corner and I'm just parked 30 feet away, right, we would have no difficulty in ascertaining that I'm now not even remotely arguably on my property, right? But it's still, I'm still just parked three spots down. It's still the short walk that Alito goes through, and I don't think there is a good way to reconcile that.
Yeah, I think he's just looking like it's the same thing where he's trying to make some what do you say, a mountain out of a molehill or whatever. Where it's like, okay, if I drop my wallet on the way into my house, yes, you can search it because I technically dropped it just outside the boundary of my house, versus if I dropped it crossing the threshold of my door going into my house, that's only 3 inches of space that determines that you can search it versus not. And it's like, yeah, because that's the nature of boundaries that we have to draw. Otherwise, we can't, you know what I mean? Like, it's not meaningful to me.
I agree. I think it's really, really interesting that this Alito decision has virtually no citations in it. We find that as a common
this is my disdain for this wing of the court that I know some people were reacting to the fact that we were really dismayed about Masterpiece Cake Shop a while back, and but I really think it's frustrating. I don't know what else to say. Like, the fact that some of these decisions are just not, you know, because of our politics and because the right has decided to, you know, populate the court with originalists. Like, it just means that people want to, what I'm trying to say is, people want to treat the Supreme Court like, oh, well, it's 5-4 either way. You know, it's going to be a reasonable thing. You shouldn't be that outraged either way, you know, kind of thing. I feel like that's their expectation. And it's like, No, when you've populated it with three or four nut jobs, then yes, it's not, you know, it's not going to always be reasonable either way.
I agree. So, so there we go. That was our first 8-1 case.
I'm excited. See what you think about this. Fun game. Here we go. Case number two.
Again, very recent decision. This is Sveen versus Melin, M-E-L-I-N. And I was reading this, I giggled because I remembered watching the Winter Olympics. I love curling. I love watching the curling in the Winter Olympics.
You and everybody else who thinks they're the only ones. Go on.
Right. Right. And so like the Scandinavian team kept screaming out like sweep, sweep every time they wanted you to sweep the little brush thing. And so every time I read Sveen, I was saying it in my head as Sveen, Sveen. So anyway, there we go. This is the Sveen case. This is also an 8-1 decision. And let's keep it up. Let's just start with the facts. Okay. In 2002, the state of Minnesota passed a law. And that law says if one spouse designates the other as a beneficiary, okay, and then gets divorced, then that designation is automatically revoked.
Okay? Interesting.
And so, yeah, so here's the way the law says it. It says the dissolution or annulment of a marriage revokes any revocable disposition, beneficiary designation, or appointment of property made by an individual to the individual's former spouse in a governing instrument. Okay. And here, under the law, governing instrument includes a life insurance policy, right, along with wills, other instruments, right? And the idea behind the law is to try and get at the intent of the parties, right? And it says, generally speaking, we think you may have amicable divorces, but chances are if you divorce your spouse, then you probably don't want them getting the money that they were getting when you were married to your spouse. And so even if you've forgotten to change your beneficiary on your life insurance policy, that it should be presumed to not go to the primary beneficiary and then to go to the alternate beneficiaries instead. And the basis, and I should add, the law also provides for the individual to override the provisions of the law, right? Like there are certainly some cases where people get divorced. They're still on good terms. And so you would say, well, you know what? I still want my ex-wife to be the beneficiary of this policy.
Yeah, especially kids involved, like, you know, maybe part of being the beneficiary, you'd want them to have the money to look after kids or something. So
yep,
makes sense.
Exactly right. So, and, or even like, yeah, you know what? We're just no longer compatible, but I still respect my ex-wife and I still want her to be the executor of my estate, right? Like, you know, there are lots of reasons where you might do that. But what the law says is we're going to presume that you don't. And if you do, if you're in the sort of rare case where you do, then all you have to do is specify it. And now, here's the case that happened, and you can probably see immediately where the issue is going to be. So this involves a couple, Mark Sveen and Kay Melin, who were married in 1997. That's before the law. Then 1998, Sveen buys a life insurance policy. He names Melin as the primary beneficiary, and then designating his two children from a prior marriage, Ashley and Anton Sveen, as the contingent beneficiaries. So that's,
I think we're going to find out this guy's going to be three or four marriages in by the time this is all said and done.
No, it's totally straightforward. This is why I love this case. It's a totally straightforward fact pattern, right? So he names his wife as the primary beneficiary and then says, as you do in a life insurance policy, and if my primary beneficiary predeceases me, then the contingent beneficiaries are my kids, right? Mm-hmm. So if I die, my wife's still alive, goes to my wife. If I die, but my wife died first, goes to the kids.
Right. But you said kids were from even a prior marriage.
Yeah, they were.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
But then their marriage ended in divorce in 2007.
That's what I was saying. He's going to be on his third wife. Okay. I don't know why you said I was wrong about that, but okay, go ahead.
Well, I don't know that he remarried after that.
Yeah. Technicality. All right.
I enjoy being technically correct.
It is you the best are technically correct. I was just being a little funny in how I said third or fourth, and you ruined my joke. Go on.
All right. The divorce decree made no mention of the insurance policy one way or the other. And Sveen took no action at the time to revise his beneficiary designations. And then he dies in 2011. And now you have a dispute in probate court. The kids come forward and they say, look, under Minnesota law, we presume that when you've divorced, that crosses off the ex-wife as the primary beneficiary, and we're the secondary contingent beneficiaries, so the money should go to us. Whereas the wife went to court and she made two arguments. Her first argument was, this contract was executed in 1998, and the law wasn't passed until 2002, and he never made any motion to, he never took any steps to change the beneficiaries, take me off the policy. Could have done that, but he didn't, and so it should go to me. The trial court ruled for the kids, but that was reversed by the Eighth Circuit. The Eighth Circuit ruled for the ex-wife on pretty unique grounds, right? On a provision of the Constitution that's incredibly rare, that's called the Contracts Clause. Okay, and that is Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution that says, no state shall pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts. So the argument is, for everything going forward, it's perfectly okay for Minnesota to say, you will understand that your contracts going forward after 2002, if you sign a life insurance policy, that will be interpreted in the way that we've set forth, right? So you get divorced, it'll automatically exclude your ex-wife, ex-husband as the primary beneficiary. But if it's before then, the Eighth Circuit rules, you can't go back and retroactively change a contract that somebody signed prior to the law going into effect.
I see. Yeah, it makes sense.
The counter argument back to that at the Supreme Court level is, yeah, you know, it's all well and good to talk about the law of contracts, but when you're talking about marital property, right, when you're talking about the disposition of obligations in a divorce, courts get involved with this kind of stuff all the time. Right. That it's we overturn contracts. Right. If I execute a contract while I'm married in a community property state and say, hey, I want 100% to go to you, between you and I, Thomas, and then I get divorced. Right. The court may come in and rewrite that contract anyway. Right. It may take it away, take away your interest and say, no, you know what? I didn't have that interest to convey to you because my 50% of that belongs to my wife in a community property state.
Good point.
So, and we could delve into it a little more, but I think I've given you enough to pick out to sort of know between the issues. So there you go. You have on the one hand the interpretation of the Minnesota statute, which is designed to further the intent of the parties by making conclusions about how people would tend to want to treat their former spouses. On the other hand, the Contracts Clause provision of the Constitution saying, yeah, but you can't do that retroactively. You can do it prospectively. Knowing that the court is 8-1, how do you think it came out?
Wow. So just also to review, the first court said kids, and then the Eighth Circuit said you're the ex-wife because of the Contracts Clause. Is that what it was?
Correct.
Boy, this is really hard. I feel like I'm surprised this is 8-1 because I feel like, well, it's not, it doesn't strike me as that political a question. So it could be another reason. My theory that the more politically charged ones would be the more 5-4-y ones. But yeah, I mean, both sides seem reasonable. Like the idea that, okay, this is what the law says, the kids get it, versus, well, the law kind of retroactively changes the face of this contract. But then also the comeback argument of, you know, well, courts will do that all the time. Gosh. Okay. Well, if we're going to go with Justice Thomas Smith, my opinion would be that you should grandfather this in, because you bring up the example of, okay, you and I form a contract and then, you know, it turns out you didn't have that money to give me anyway, because, you know, it was due to your wife or whatever. I see that, but I also think that information was available at the time of the contract. But if subsequently then a law is passed that's like, oh no, now this is what will happen when you die. Like, I feel like there's a difference there. I don't, now this is just Justice Thomas Smith. I don't know that that'll be the way the court is thinking, but that's kind of a distinction I would draw. Like, it's one thing to say, yes, courts intervene in these contracts, you know, to make sure things are fair. But it's another, I think, to say you signed a contract that was totally consistent and fine with the information you had at the time, but then like the law changes how that will actually happen. I feel like that's a different thing, you know, like you didn't have that information at the time. You couldn't have made that determination. So I don't know. It's a, I have no confidence in this one because I think it's solid arguments on either end, but maybe once you tell me more about the decision, maybe I'll fall one way or the other. But if I have to take a guess, I'll go with Justice Thomas Smith. I'll go with, he seems like a bright guy. I will say that the Supreme Court upheld the Eighth Circuit decision, which was in favor of the ex-wife, right?
Yes.
Yes. I will say that. And I will say the dissent, well, okay, maybe I'm falling into a pattern here, but I feel like the dissent is going to be a cranky, you know, right winger or something, or maybe not, you know, because this is a weird one. So who would dissent from that? The nature of this dissent could be, if I'm analyzing this right, which this is a lot of ifs, but if what I was saying was true, the nature of this dissent could be essentially like a big government thing. Like, no, the government does have the power to retroactively change contracts. And that strikes me as more of a lefty thing. So maybe I'll go with Sotomayor. How about that? I'll go with Sotomayor. Just change it up. That's who dissented. There's my answer. Hey, folks, we're going to find out if that answer was right in a second. But first, I've got to tell you about our sponsor, FrameBridge.com. They make it easy and affordable to custom frame your favorite things from art prints and posters to the photos on your phone. Here's how it works. You go to FrameBridge.com. You upload your photo from your computer or directly from your Instagram feed, which, by the way, is what I did. Let's say you're someone like me who has a million amazing pictures of baby opening arguments Phoebe Smith on Instagram and you want to get some of them framed, you can use this. It's super cool. Or if you have a plain old physical item, a non-Instagram internet-y thing like ticket stubs, art prints, posters, whatever it is, they'll provide secure prepaid packaging so you can mail it in for free. You can preview your item online in any frame style and you get to choose your favorite or get free recommendations from talented designers if you want to do that. And once you choose, the expert team at FrameBridge will custom frame your item in days, not weeks or months, in days, and they will deliver your finished piece directly to your door, ready to hang. The best part is, while framing something at a store can cost hundreds of dollars, their prices start at $39 and all shipping is free. Plus, our listeners will get 15% off their first order at FrameBridge.com when they use the code OA. Not only that, they also have a happiness guarantee. If there's any reason you aren't 100% satisfied with your order, they'll make it right. I am really excited about the three pictures of Phoebe I've decided to frame. One is with me, one's with Lydia, and then one's by herself. I think it's going to make a really nice little set. And I am just so excited that all I have to do is log into my Instagram and I can just pull the photos over. So folks, get started framing your photos or art today. Go to FrameBridge.com and use promo code OA and you'll save 15% off your first order. FrameBridge.com, promo code OA. One more time, that's FrameBridge.com, promo code OA.
All right. I love this. We're gonna play the same game, right? The same right. Monty Hall game. I'm going to tell you the
you're gonna eliminate Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes and then ask me if I wanna guess again. I'll say no, because that has no impact on what I'm saying.
I'm going to eliminate Anthony Kennedy, right?
Okay. That's a strong one.
Right. The dissent was not authored by Anthony Kennedy. And I'm gonna read you my favorite line from the dissent. And we'll see if you want to stick with your original choice or go for what's in the box. So, my favorite line from the dissent, couple of lines. The judicial power to declare a law unconstitutional should never be lightly invoked, but the law before us cannot survive an encounter with even the breeziest of contracts clause tests. It substantially impairs life insurance contracts by retroactively revising their key term. No one can offer any reasonable justification for this impairment in light of readily available alternatives. So, knowing it's not Anthony Kennedy, You've seen that curtain. We pulled it away. It's a zonk. It's Anthony Kennedy as a donkey being ridden by, you know, whatever.
Okay. So obviously that changes the outcome because it sounds like the person who is crankily mad about this decision was saying this is definitely unconstitutional. That means the majority ruled in favor of the kids. And this person is like, you're out of your damn minds. So that changes. So that does, that definitely changes me from Sotomayor. I don't know. That's not that cranky. Let's see. I'm going to go for what's in the box. I'm changing my answer. I'm not confident, but I'm going to say Gorsuch.
All right. You have gone 2 for 2.
Wow. Let's all make right. a deal. I'm kicking ass at this game. I mean, I got the original decision wrong, but,
right.
but
Justice yeah, Thomas no. Smith is.
I feel like I've, you know what, Andrew? I feel like I've learned a lot about the justices from you. I feel like I've got a certain feel for them, a little bit, just a little bit.
Well, Justice Thomas Smith is, in fact, Justice Neil Gorsuch. This was an 8-1 decision
oh,
in favor
minute.
Of the case.
That just took a dark turn. Oh, man. Okay.
And this one, unlike, I was trying to throw you a curveball, but I can't fool you. This one breaks down on very, very traditional lines, which I'm about
it's
to go through,
one.
Even though
what
it's 8-1, right?
Oh, is there like concurrences or something?
No, it is. There are no other concurrences. The 8-justice majority recognizes the jurisprudence of the Commerce Clause, right? Which says throughout our history that in order to, right, even though it says, you know, shall not impair the obligations of a contract, right? Like the way in which you interpret that under ordinary norms of jurisprudence is the same way you interpret, right? Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, right? Like that doesn't mean, you know, you can't, Congress can't pass a law preventing you from libeling someone or, you know, disclosing military secrets, right? We say it doesn't count as freedom of speech in those cases. So despite the plain language of the First Amendment, nevertheless, you know, no law doesn't mean no law. And similarly, the contracts clause, right? No impairment, right? No state shall pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts. The question is, what counts as impairment? And as the decision says, from time immemorial, this court has applied a 2-step test. The threshold issue is whether the state law has operated as a substantial impairment to the contractual relationship. In answering that question, the court considers the extent to which the law undermines the contractual bargain, interferes with a party's reasonable expectations, and prevents the party from safeguarding or reinstating his rights. If such factors show a substantial impairment, the inquiry then turns to the means and ends of the legislation. In particular, the court asks whether the state law is drawn in an appropriate and reasonable way to advance a significant and legitimate public purpose. And here, the majority says, look, this is not a substantial impairment of the contract for a bunch of reasons, right? Primarily because you still retain all of your rights, right? It changes the presumption, but you can go back and say, no, I definitely want to keep my wife as the beneficiary. And this is designed to promote rather than interfere with the party's reasonable expectations, right? We have no idea here on the facts of this case whether Savine wanted his ex-wife to get the life insurance or whether he wanted his kids to get the life insurance, right? Mm. We don't know. And so part of what the jurisprudence around the Commerce Clause is meant to protect is to say, look, it would be a problem if you had a specific expectation when you entered into the life insurance policy, right? If you said, no, I definitely want this to be adjudicated in this particular way, and then the law changes it up on you, right?
Yeah.
But the premise is we don't know that you had that expert. We have to guess, right? And we're guessing a lot. But you know what? The legislature's best guess here, right, on the basis of people who are accountable to the public is, yeah, you know what? Probably the other way is more likely. Like, typically speaking, people get divorced. They don't want their ex-wife to get the benefit of stuff.
Yeah, and they just,
they
like, forget to change the...
Yeah, and they just forget because they've got a whole bunch of stuff lying around. And who remembers to go back and change
all right,
your
I'll say this. If the question is this law unconstitutional on its face, I'd say, well, no, I don't think that. But I did think that maybe the grandfathering period would make sense, but maybe that's not the right thing to have been trying to evaluate in this case. Is that right? But then,
oh no, I think that's right. And I want to point out, right, that there has been, I think, unwarranted liberal freakout because it's a Gorsuch dissent. And look, and Gorsuch is a monster. Don't get, you know, let's, I'm not recanting that in any way.
Right.
But I have seen a couple of sources describe this opinion as Gorsuch saying the government can't interfere with contracts at all. And that's not correct.
Yeah, right? That's, you know, Justice Thomas Smith doesn't think that either.
Yeah. you and Gorsuch are
apparently
we're
the same
now,
dude
so.
Now. Right. So.
Gorsuch says, I'm going to quote him directly. This is page one of his dissent. Everyone agrees that the law is valid when applied prospectively to policies purchased after the statute's enactment. Okay. Yeah. So it is only
about. I will
about,
say this. I mean, I don't think, yeah, I'm with you unless I'm missing something. This doesn't seem like that unreasonable of a dissent. I feel like I was pretty 50-50 on this. So, yeah. You know, like I really could see it going either way. I don't know.
I think you could. Until then, you delve into, and I think from a results
perspective.
Let me
ask, what would Justice Andrew Torres rule on this?
So, if I had to choose which opinion to sign on to, I would sign on to the majority opinion for the reasons that I'm about to explain. But in a vacuum, and again, you know, it in a vacuum, I agree with you, right? Like, which is to say, I think it is a close question, and I think it is reasonable to come out the other way on the question of the retroactive applicability. I think what would push me over the edge is actually even without the argumentation in Gorsuch's dissent, which I can't sign on to for reasons that will become immediately apparent. I think his question at the end, right, where which I read to you before you guessed, right, the we should not take lightly the notion to declare a law unconstitutional. I think I would take that and run with it. And I would say, hey, you know what? Like when you're talking about the impairment of contracts, everything the government does that regulates business, that regulates personal behavior, that is the business of the modern state, could be argued to interfere with contracts in some way. It's an important decision, sure. You don't want a government just invalidating contracts on face, but I would want that not to be read that expansively, and I don't think this would rise to the level of my saying that it's inappropriate for the citizens of the state of Missouri to say no on basis, right? You know, on when we're trying to adjudicate questions of unknown intent, right? When we have questions of known intent, the law doesn't apply. Right. If you go back and say, I want this to cover my ex-wife, then we know your intent. Right. You've written it down. So the law doesn't apply and the law shouldn't.
And
apply.
You're able to do that when you originally draw it up and just say like, yeah. OK.
And if you wanted to. Right. That's exactly right. You could put in, you know, I want this to go to my ex-wife, even if we get divorced.
Well,
right?
And again, though, that was the problem I have with it is that for these things that were drawn up before the law. There's no way you could have you could not have known to do that. But correct. The only response is once the law was passed, then you could have remembered to change, you know, write a note or something. Right. And I don't know. I still feel like that's reasonable to say that started going forward.
I don't think I agree with you. I mean, like I said, I agree with you. I couldn't sign on to this dissent because dissent is cribbed entirely from a 1987 Law Review article entitled The Contract Clause, A Return to the Original Understanding, disregards, 100 years of precedent in favor of a rule that says any legislative derivation from a contract's obligations, however minute or apparently immaterial, violates the Constitution.
Okay, yeah, I would not sign on to that either. I was not signing on to that. Okay.
Yeah. But that's why Gorsuch wanted to dissent in this case. He wanted to advocate a robust reading of the contracts clause. I am surprised, given that it's an 8-1 decision, and given that the 8-1 decision criticizes Gorsuch on this particular point, that it doesn't go where I'm about to go, right? So let me explain the criticism. Gorsuch says the contracts clause applies to prohibit legislative interference with existing contracts, however minute or apparently immaterial. And then he says, and the problem is that the justification that the majority opinion gives is that probate courts and divorce courts all the time rewrite property in order to and rewrite contracts in order to distribute marital property in divorce situations. And Gorsuch says, look, there's a difference between the court rewriting it and a legislature rewriting it. Two different harms. Only one was meant to be prohibited by the Constitution. And where I'm surprised is that the majority didn't point out that taken literally, I'm sure Gorsuch would come up with some kind of distinction for this.
They always do.
But we have, I mean, one of the most celebrated cases at the Supreme Court level, not one we've talked about before, but I think we've mentioned it, in passing or parenthetically, is a case called Shelley versus Kramer. It's a 1948 opinion. And that invalidated racially restrictive covenants as violating the 14th Amendment. And it's not hard to craft the hypothetical here, right? Now, look, again, that was a judicial decision invalidating contracts under the 14th Amendment. But the hypothetical would be, okay, that was 1948. So it's 1940. The state of Missouri decides that they're going to invalidate racially restrictive covenants. And they pass a law saying you cannot enforce a contract that says, as those did, right, this property shall not be used or occupied by any person or persons except those of the Caucasian race. Gorsuch's reading is that legislatures don't have the power to strike that down. That would be really, really troubling. And again, I'm sure he would come up with some kind of, well, if it's manifest illegality or whatever. But I mean, that's sort of where my mind goes when I think about the government interfering in private contracts, right? Government doesn't like to interfere in private contracts, left or right. I mean, as you pointed out from your initial take on the case, like, this is not a scenario where that breaks down cleanly on ideological lines in reaching an outcome, because even liberal justices generally like to uphold the expectation of individuals who engage in contract. And so that's where, when I look at, I mean, the two things that kind of sway me the other way are obviously are interrelated, right? Are the question of how do we interpret this contracts clause? And in fact, in history, how has the Supreme Court interpreted the contracts clause? And they've read it as a more as a more narrow restriction on the power of legislatures. And I would want to keep that up, right? I would want to maintain the ability for us to say, look, we can affect change both at the legislative level and through the judiciary. Should it be, you know, should you have to meet the criteria? You should absolutely have to meet the criteria, right? Should you be able, you know, to blot obligations on a contract out of existence? No, you shouldn't, right? So for example, if the Minnesota statute here prevented you from redesignating your ex-wife, right? I mean, if it just said, nope, sorry, like we, you know, I don't know, MRAs get in and control the Minnesota legislature and are like, nope, ex-wives get nothing. Never, even if you want them to. Yeah, I agree with that, that now you've gone too far. But I don't know that I would calibrate the question of whether they can do that all the way back at the presumption level.
Wow. Well, interesting. No, good points. I think it is close, but I see what you mean where you couldn't sign on to Gorsuch's language. And I just want to clarify, Justice Thomas Smith did not use that same language in his ruling, just so we're all clear.
Yeah. When is your next fishing date with Neil Gorsuch, your new BFF?
The important thing is that I was right two times in a row. That's the important thing. Now, I did need the Monty Hall help, I guess, but still. Okay. That was fun. Really cool segment. I enjoyed that. Thank you so much. And now we are going to answer a question from Twitter user Martin at the Buttons with a Z.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
Martin asks, I have a legal practice question. How do partners pick law partners? podcast partners. They make good. question pondered following the OAEP re Egan Avenatti. Just curious, do you pick like-minded partners, conversely minded, split from a wider practice, etc.? Oh, huh, interesting. If I take a guess, I would guess that most of the time it's probably just like your buddy. But maybe not. What do you have to say about that?
So, yeah, I really enjoyed the question. I thought it was a neat way to kind of delve into the way in which law firms are organized, which has changed drastically in the past 20 years. Things are different now than they were when this language was, really sort of fell into common parlance. So first, let me answer the question directly, which is law firms pick partners on the basis of people they think will bring more money into the firm as a partner than they will be paid out from the profits of the firm. That's it. That is 100% the criteria that goes into it. Mm. If you are, we have a lot of lawyers who listen to the show. If you are an associate at a law firm and you are on the partnership track, as I was back, then and the firm is telling you, we make partners for a lot of different criteria. Like, they are not telling you their criteria.
I should have guessed that their criteria is, will this person make us money?
Will this person make us money? That is, at the end of the day, you need to remember that. Right. And look, there are a couple of other things.
I think I very naively was envisioning like a mom and pop practice where they're starting up, they're like, hey, let's start up a new firm. Who do I want to partner with? That's what I was thinking.
I say it this way because I was very much in that naive situation, right? As an associate and as a partner, right? Because they will tell you, and these are ancillary criteria, right? If they don't think you can be trusted to talk to clients, run cases, if you're a litigator, try cases, right? Then that will also disqualify you. But the overwhelming criteria to the point where I'm comfortable saying it rounds up to 100%, because I think those things are encompassed by that, right? Like, if somebody can't talk to clients, they're not going to bring in any clients and they can't make any money. The overwhelming criterion is an economic criterion. That's why firms do it. Some of the other things that go into it, though, underlie the terminology of referring to law firm partners as partners. And that dates back to the fact that up until about 20 years ago, most law firms were general partnerships, right? And a general partnership is if you out there have a business with your buddy, right? And nobody has filed anything, right? You're not a company, you're not an LLC, you haven't incorporated, you're just like, we do this thing together, we run a lemonade stand together. And that's a partnership. That's a common law partnership. And the primary criteria, the primary characteristics of a common law partnership are that each of the partners is jointly and severally liable for everything the partnership does, and they are personally liable for the partnership debts. And so you could imagine in a law firm environment where that gets you into trouble, right? Because lawyers get sued for malpractice. So now I'm at a big firm and we've just brought in somebody as a partner, and that partner gets sued for malpractice. And I don't even know who he is. Right? Let's say we got 100 different partners in five offices, spread throughout the country. That's not a big firm even, right? But we're a mid-sized firm. We got a bunch of different offices. You bring in this guy, all of a sudden he's sued for malpractice, and I've got to pay for a judgment that's executed against him. I'm on the hook for that. So law firms then morphed from being a general partnership to being a limited partnership, a limited liability partnership, or even, as in the case, for example, my law firm, an LLC, a limited liability company. And the reason behind those moves were to do two things, right? Number one, to make sure that the general partners in the firm were no longer personally liable for the debts of the firm. And number two, in the cases in which you have a professional limited liability partnership in the jurisdictions that permit that, you can actually segregate out the liability of the partners each for the malpractice of the other. And so that's the whole point in dividing that out, is to try and further protect the lawyers in their individual capacities from professional liabilities made by their other partners. And so as a result, some law firms no longer refer to people as partners. Some law firms have a multi-tiered partnership practice in which they will call you a partner, but you are not actually a member for purposes of owning a share in the LLC or having a partnership share if it's an LP or an LLP. They can call you a partner for purposes of how you get to hold yourself out to clients and in court. But behind the scenes, you're not entitled to any of the equity. So you're basically an associate that they call a partner. And lots of law firms will designate somebody as of counsel, usually when you're bringing somebody in on a trial basis, right? If you say, I want to bring in somebody because I'm expanding my practice, as I did with our friend Sharon Frankel, right? That person becomes an of counsel. They are affiliated with the firm, but not part of the ownership and responsible in the same way that you would be responsible in a general partnership. So there you go.
So I think my answer was right because you picked your friend Sharon Frankel.
Well, I think you're right that in a right when you're thinking about it in the like mom and pop, you know, small business, right? Like the way my firm is run, those non-economic criteria play a much, much bigger role. But typically when you're talking about the general law firm market, the reason in which you bring in a partner is because you think you're going to make more money with the partner than without.
Right. Makes sense. All right. Well, thank you so much for the question. Thanks for the answer, Andrew. And now it is time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. Hope you're
new
enjoying
Patron Tuesday.
Yeah. New Patron Tuesday. And they begin with Chris Siloff, Bobson Dugnut. Hey, I'm a huge Bobson Dugnut fan, but I do want to point out there are other names on that Super Nintendo game or whatever the heck it was. I took legal advice from a podcast and all I got was a Patreon account. Well, then you took the right advice. Brian Wolcott, Michael Blaby, Erica Pullen, Brickman Esquire. Brickman. McGregor, I have nothing but contempt for this court. Crowley,
nice.
Jin Hada, Jim Emke, Chris Bindeman, Daniel Stockard, crime is illegal.
Yes, it is.
That one is so straightforward. Daniel Marchese or Marchese, one or the other. Thank you, folks, so much for the kind pledges.
Yeah, and thank you to Sammy Extra. That's even more Sammy. Mm. Alex, Palle Carlson, Reven. I think that's a returning patron, Reven. Thank you. Amon, Galen Brewer, Krista Manny, Kat Volk, a chimp with a machine gun. I'm so glad we have one of those around. I can think.
I'm glad they're on our side.
Yeah, right. No name, no names. Rack PTR. I don't know what that's supposed to be, but Rack PTR. Yodel Mountain Breathing Apparatus LLC. Our buddy Mark Hofeling, James Cordes, and Anonymous. I like that, trying to get in the French accent there. Thank you all so much. Couldn't do the show without you.
Absolutely.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it is time to find out whether the improbable streak continues. Tough TTTBE question. How did I do?
All right. Yeah, this is, I think we are nearing 1980 U.S. hockey team over the Soviets. If you can go two in a row. No, wait. No. Yeah. No. So this question was car owner who is washing her car on a public street in December, apparently, for no reason, violates the local ordinance that prohibits washing the vehicles on a public street during specified hours. And because of that, because she's washing the car, the water forms a puddle that freezes in the crosswalk. Pedestrian comes by, slips on the puddle, breaks her leg. The fact pattern specifies that the statute was enacted to expedite the flow of traffic, right? It's a you can't be washing your car in the street while, you know, during rush hour, and had nothing to do with pedestrian safety. Mm-hmm. And then at trial, the only evidence the plaintiff put on for negligence was the car owner's admission that she violated the statute And then at the conclusion of the trial, obviously super short trial, both sides move for a directed verdict. And the question is, does the court grant judgment in favor of the plaintiff on the issue that the defendant violated the statute? Does it grant judgment in favor of the defendant on the issue that there was no evidence of negligence? Or does it throw it out to the jury and say, oh, we're going to let the jury decide? I want to say that the primary legal issue that this question was testing is the concept of negligence per se. Negligence per se is
which
when
I said, everybody.
Yeah, no,
thank
you. Said,
you
10 you
points
got
for Thomas.
Words.
Okay.
Wow. Negligence per se is when you violate a law and that law is a criminal statute. It provides for criminal penalties, not just civil penalties. And the law was designed to protect against exactly the kind of harm that happened.
Right.
Then that defendant is negligent per se, and you don't have to demonstrate that they otherwise failed to uphold reasonable care in that situation. So you correctly identified the principle. You correctly identified that this law is not triggering negligence per se because it was meant to expedite the flow of traffic and not to prevent freezing crazy slip and fall accidents. And I love the fact you went back to the fact pattern. We're like, no, wait, that was the only evidence of negligence. So seems like the answer should be C, grant the car owner's motion because the pedestrian has failed to offer adequate evidence that the car owner was negligent. And I am pleased to tell you that is indeed the correct answer.
Oh, you really faked me out there. I thought you were about to say it was something else.
No,
I feel like this is one of the few that I've ever, I think, perfectly analyzed.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything that I, like most of the time I kind of fudged something, like I just I happened to get that right or more often wrong. This one, I actually feel like I understood all of it.
I think
amazed.
That's exactly right.
Wow.
I've got nothing more to add.
The only, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn. I'm trying to say just goes to show, folks, listen to opening arguments and you'll learn about the law.
There you go.
Wouldn't have been able to answer this a few years ago, for sure.
There you go. Well, congratulations on getting it right.
Thank you so much. I'm going to take just a brief 10-15 minutes to talk about that and revel in the glory of fame and fortune. No, let's hop in your limited use TARDIS. And, so that's copyright infringement. Sorry, it's a limited use time machine. Maybe we can come up with a lawyer themed time machine. Let's see. Like a limited use time traveling liquor drawer that what do lawyers use? I don't know. Liquor drawer in their desk. Something like that. And tell us, who is this week's winner who we will bathe in fame and fortune, which is absolutely not guaranteed.
All right, Thomas, we have an unusual winner this week. It is someone named Brian Ziegenhagen at Zaguriel on Twitter who says, I'm on vacation and didn't edit, so I get to participate in TTTBE. The answer is C, because making free public ice skating rinks can never be a crime. Pretty sure it's in our greatest law book, the Bible. Brian, happy to get the question right. He's never going to be eligible to play again. It was a pretty good quip. So this once only, Brian Ziegenhagen is our winner. He already has never-ending fame and fortune, but we're going to give him an extra special shout-out on this week's episode. Congratulations on getting it right, Brian. Hope you had a great vacation.
Thank you so much for listening, and really cool episode, Andrew. I love this. That was fun.
I had a lot of fun. I'm glad you did too.
Yeah, that was really fun. Thanks for that. And thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you very soon, I'm sure.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.